Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for July 10th, 2011. Big show tonight. Anissa Jones, who's running for State House in Middle Georgia, will be on with us. And then in the second half hour, somebody we've had on at least one time before, who is one of the most expert minds in Mississippi politics, Robert Hooks, will be joining us about 7:35 Eastern Standard Time, 6:35 for those folks that are probably tuning in because they're getting ready to hear him here in a little while. But as always, welcome from Atlanta, Catherine Smith.
Hello, everyone.
And from Somerville, Georgia, welcome, Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
Yes. Well, we're going to talk about a few topics here and there in between our guests, but one that kind of caught my eye, David Neer put it on elections@dailycos.com. David, of course, friend of the show, but it was very interesting. It was talking about Act Blue and how successful Act Blue's been. And there's other services that Democrats and progressives use. But it would only make sense that Republicans are, you know, they're pretty decent at raising political funds as well, these pioneer groups and whatnot. But anytime a Republican group has come up and tried to raise money in a similar fashion to Act Blue, it's never been really successful. And I believe he goes through three generations of the thing. I'm tongue-tied. And none of them are successful. They all say we'll be back for the next cycle and whatnot. Catherine, since you've kind of been, I guess, more in with maybe raising money online for political causes and progressive causes, I know Blog for Democracy does a little bit of that here and there. Why do you think the problems are for the right?
Well, I wonder if it might be that I haven't really thought about it extensively. But I wonder if it has something to do with, I know that the right is online. I mean, that's clear. But I wonder if I'm just guessing, if the activists are not as tuned into the sort of ability to make those contributions online and sort of the, you know, all the infrastructure and how important it is to, you know, make those low dollar contributions. You know, it really, most of that started with the Dean campaign, I think. That was the first time I saw it in, you know, full on constant contact. And then, of course, the 2008 Obama campaign, you know, took it to incredible heights with fundraising online, and I'm not on all the Republican lists, but I don't recall a lot of reporting on the online strategies, and so I suspect that it's just a lack of ability to reach those people that are able to make those contributions.
Yeah, not on all the Republican list. Catherine, I'd love to know what gets you on a Republican list and what's not, but that's
well,
a different
topic.
Well, I
don't know what gets me on a Republican list, but I have gotten on a few of them, and I can take, you know, when I tune into the radio to listen to Neil Bortz or Sean Hannity or whatever, but that's my choice. But when they start coming at me, I back off and delete them and, you know, unsubscribe promptly.
Yeah. Well, Tim, you saw there was three different groups mentioned there. Big Red Tent, mm-hmm. I'd honestly never heard of. I think Slate Card is the one I've heard the most about. And I'd also heard of one called Right Click, which I think that's kind of gone away because if you go to Right Click, the number one thing is just some computer service, if you will. It's not. So there's another one that David probably could have put in the article that's gone away. What do you think is going on here?
The right
The right has always, for some reason, been running a bit behind progressive leaning groups on the internet in general. They make up for it, of course, by dominating talk radio, and they hold their own in grassroots activities. But and they, of course, raise huge sums from big business and from big private donors. The internet has actually, it's really kept the Democrats in the game financially. No one used the internet to greater advantage than President Obama's campaign in 08. I got to be honest, that was the darndest thing I've ever seen. The way that they were able to connect with people on the internet and raise all kind of money from small donors. You might have seen the recent figures that showed that they just raised a bunch of money in the last reporting period from 400,000 different donors, at many of them on the internet. The Republicans have just, they've not been able to do that. Thanks to the internet, money will not be an issue for the Democrats in next year's election. That's how important the internet is. Now, I still can't touch on why that is. Why are progressives so strong on this particular medium, and conservatives and right-leaning groups just don't seem to gain any traction there? Is there not to be found there, or I don't know.
It goes beyond their behind, because if you look, liberal blogosphere sites, you know, maybe Daily Kos has more readers than Red State, or you know, we could keep going down the list. But they do have a presence there. If you look at Blog Talk Radio, the Republican shows outpace the Democratic shows. You know, we at times can be number one or number two, and we won't show up in the top ten because they're all Republican shows. So there are areas that the Republicans do well on the internet, but they just—I mean—they're non-existent in this space, if you will.
I have another thought. I think Tim touched on it, and I think that the Democrats face the same problem. I think a lot of times fundraisers and, you know, sort of finance directors are really focused on, you know, the bigger donations. They think, you know, why bother with $50? You know, why even bother with it? And I think that, you know, that's sort of the old school approach to fundraising. You know, go out and get the 500 and above, and, you know, the 5,000 and the, you know, the big money, and don't even bother with the little money because it takes so, it's so hard to get. You know, it's so expensive to get that $50. But I think that what we're learning is if you can get someone to make a small contribution once, and then you show them that their money is being used well and that they believe the same things that you believe, that you can continue to hit that, you know, you can go back to them time and time again to get more money. And it becomes less expensive as you, I mean, it's, sure, if you have to call them on the phone and ask for that money, but with the advent of, you know, all these internet, you know, strategies, whether it's email or Twitter or Facebook or just websites, whatever, there's so many options. I think that those, it's becoming less costly to get those smaller donations. And I just think some of the old school finance directors and fundraisers aren't on board with that yet.
Well, and probably there may be a commission component involved there too. But like I said, it's almost like fishing, whereas you have to cast over and over and over, but with internet fundraising, a lot of times you set up the mechanism almost like you lay a trap out in the water and just leave it there and you pull it in every so often. I mean, it's a different workload. Tim?
So on the internet, it would be relatively inexpensive to set up this sort of thing to raise funds from small donors. And I think a lot of these people may be people who have never given a dime to a political campaign before and feel intimidated when somebody calls them. But if it's some college kid
and somebody's saying, can't you give $5 on the internet? Hey, that's something that everybody can take a bite out of. How many $5 and $10 donors are out there, and even $50 donors like Catherine's talking about, that's going to help realize this goal that the president's reelection team has of raising $1 billion? I think a significant group of people, you know.
I've always said, I've said this, you know, to party fundraisers, to candidates, the $20 donation that you get from the person that can't afford it is more important and more valuable than the $1,000 contribution from the person that can well afford it. Because once you get them, you've got them. They've made their investment, even if it's only $20. And if you can show proof of performance and show that you're, that the likelihood of you getting elected is much better if you contribute more, then you'll continue to get money from them. Do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, it's sort of anti-intuitive. It's counterintuitive, but I think it is a valuable thing to recognize, that those donations are very important, those small donations.
David,
and especially if you have a huge campaign, they add up.
Yeah, David, I'll tell you something. We cannot argue with the success that the president's election team had with this 3 years ago. I mean, it's there. It's fact. It happened. These little donors on the internet add up, and I've never seen anybody tap into it like they did. It was amazing to see it unfold, because frankly, I never thought anything like that could happen, and we have now seen that it can, and it's the Democrats that are at the forefront of this, thank goodness. And what I keep coming back to is, why are the Republicans not doing the same thing in the same time?
Yeah, because the first big internet fundraiser was actually John McCain in 2000, raised a ton of money online in 24-hour periods and whatnot. And so, and this is institutional. This isn't one candidate. I'm sure you're going to see a candidate on the Republican side for president jump up and, you know, work it. But then as a, you know, institutional, hey, how can we keep this going? And the thing with ActBlue that's different is, obviously, I mean, anybody can go raise money. I mean, they can set up a PayPal account. They can use services that charge varying degrees of fees, or they can, of course, go through a bank, which is a, you know, a very entangled, complicated process. What's nice about ActBlue is, of course, they take some of the legwork and complication out of it, just because, and not even trying to make a lot of money. I know there are things they take, and sometimes they ask for tips to run the service, which is very realistic. But there's nobody on the Republican side saying, let's take all this legwork out to help our candidates. Yes, Tim.
Yeah, well, what did David Deere say in his excellent article? I believe that ActBlue has been around since 2004. Why do they have staying power? And the Republican or conservative versions of this did not.
Yeah.
Well, you know, maybe it's just that Democrats are more generous.
there are obviously the true believers that may not necessarily want to donate to Republican campaigns. I mean, obviously the Tea Party movement probably takes in funds, and that's not trying to, I guess, feather anybody's cap like, say, the pioneers that the Bush campaign, you know, with all oil men trying to, you know, have deregulation for every natural resource industry there was. So, I mean, you know, you're looking at some people would still donate. This is a mechanism issue. I mean, you have to wonder. I mean, you know, the Republican side, they have actually, they were the ones that really pioneered direct mail and direct mail fundraising early on. That Richard Viguerie, I believe, he's like the guru for that kind of thing.
So why have they not taken advantage with what to me would be the easiest medium through which to raise money and reach people? Practically everybody has got one of these things in their house now. Don't they go after those people?
I
have to wonder. I'd be interested to know if they are going after them and it hasn't been successful, or if they just aren't going after them. You know what I mean? Like, do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, are they trying and it's not succeeding, or are they not really even trying?
David, is the internet just more friendly to progressives? Is the internet more likely to be progressive? Is that what it is?
It can be anything. I mean, it's basically, it's what's the old Piccadilly Square or whatever at our Speaker's Corner over in London. I mean, it's, you know, it's just there. It's whoever joins up can have their piece, and you could find incredibly far right-wing things and incredibly far left-wing things and everywhere in between, but they're just not taking advantage in this space for whatever reason. And I think David puts up an interesting point in his article, so that's why I thought it was noteworthy. Well, now it's time for our first guest of the evening from Macon, Georgia. Joining us is Miss Anissa Jones. Welcome, Miss Jones.
Hi, how you doing?
Good to have you on the Kudzu Vine.
Yeah, I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you. Now, you're running for State House coming up, I guess, in just a few weeks, this special election. Tell us a little bit about the election itself and how it came about.
Well, the seat is for the House seat in District 139 here in Macon and Bibb County. And what has happened is that then-Senator Robert Brown, he decided to leave his Senate seat and run for mayor here in Macon. And House Representative David Lucas, he decided to relinquish his House seat so that he could run for the Senate seat, which left his seat vacant for me to pursue this.
Yes, and so next thing we have is tell us a little bit about your background so people that are interested in this race can find out more about you.
All right, well, I'm 39 years old. I'll be 40 on tomorrow, and I am a chiropractor as well as a professor of biology down at Fort Valley State University. And I'm running for this state representative seat here in the District 139 because I really care passionately about improving our community and our state, and I want to help shape the future of the district that has defined the person that I am today.
Yes. Well, I'm not the only person. Oh, go ahead. I'm not the only person on the show. I also have with me my co-host Tim Shiflett and Catherine Smith. I'm going to send this around to them for some questions.
Hi, guys.
Catherine,
how
your
you
question
doing today?
For Anissa Jones.
Hey, Anissa, thank you so much for being on the show, especially on
yes.
the day before your birthday. I hope you have a wonderful birthday tomorrow.
Thank you.
What's happening and what are the things that are – I noticed on your website that it looks like, you know, jobs, education – are the primary things. What are the concerns that your potential constituents have that are really specific to your district? And then also what issues beyond your district?
Okay, as far as my district has a huge poverty issue. And so it's going to be imperative that I fight to create jobs and I eliminate them in this area. And one way that I think that we should go about doing that here for our city as a whole, which will have an effect on that district, is we need to try to establish ourselves as a city that's capable of handling conventions on a large scale. You know, people go to Las Vegas and take their convention to Las Vegas, Atlanta, because they have the capacity to be able to take care of those type of conventions. And we can do that here in the city because we can continue to build on what we started. The city invested in the Marriott and Convention Center here, and we need to continue with that effort. Also, some of the other things that we can do is we have a revitalization of our downtown Cherry Street, and we need to build on our rich music history that we have here in the city. Cherry Street should be the entertainment hub of Macon, and we can emulate, you know, Riverwalk Inn and Savannah, Beale Street in Nashville, Bourbon Street in New Orleans, and not only will this bring jobs to our community, we'll have visitors that will be here to kind of help, you know, pay some of those taxes on those sales of those items. So that's a great thing. You know, CNBC ranked Georgia fourth best state to do business in and first in entrepreneurial activity. So this is great news for Georgia. But so only thing we need to do is make our city and where it's marketable so that we can fall in line with the rest of the state. Some of the other things that I want to do is, especially when it comes to education, is I want to initiate some programs that are going to help increase the performance levels in our schools so that our schools can be compatible not only with the state, but other schools in the state, but with the whole country as a whole. And one of the things that I'm looking into doing is it's going to be a coalition of retired teachers, and what they're going to do is they're going to serve to sort of stand in the gap for our parents. A lot of our parents, they're not engaged because they don't want to be engaged. They're not engaged because they have to work. They're going to work 2 and 3 jobs, you know, just to make ends meet for their family. So the purpose of the coalition would be to fill the gaps for the parents. And we know that stats show that parental and guardian involvement increases performance levels in schools. So as an educator, you know, I have to always seek to empower our parents and our teachers to make more decisions in our children's education. And the best decisions are going to be made closest to the people, and they should be handled that way. And it really takes a village. We have to continue to defend, you know, our American values, and the center of America is our family. And it's important that we recognize that for the source of strength that it is. So we have to continue to support, you know, funds to our K-12 schools so that we can ensure that we don't, you know, ensure that we are, you know, lowering incarceration rates, decreasing poverty, increased tolerance to others, along with a whole host of other things and benefits. And unfortunately, our schools now are no longer just teaching reading, writing, and math. They're having to combat social issues that extend far beyond performance. They have to deal with things like malnutrition, drugs, sex. So they're dealing with things that's far from performance measures in core academic areas. One of the other things that I like to see addressed in my district is we have a lot of dilapidated houses, and so I have this philosophy: use or remove. You know, so we're going to have to get some initiatives in place so that we can upgrade our affordable housing, and we have to make sure that we're holding people accountable for their homes that are not in use in our neighborhood, in our community. And so when these homes are left in place, they're not only an eyesore for as it relates to community development, but they tend to attract criminal acts, you know. And so if I'm elected, I'm going to work with the city to either use or remove these homes out of there. So those are just a few of the things that I'm passionate about as it relates to this district, which overall have an effect on the state.
Well, you sounds like you have a full plate of ideas, and that's great. It's fantastic. I'm going to turn this over to Tim now. Go ahead, Tim.
Hi, Tim.
Well, good evening, Dr. Jones. You're a healthcare professional.
Yes.
You are a professor, and yes, you're a retail business owner.
Mm-hmm.
But as a legislator, what's the first thing that Anissa Jones would like to help get done for the 139th District? Which one of those hats do you feel you should wear to the forefront?
I think the hat that I should wear when I'm up there in the state is going to be the hat of an educator, because education and lack thereof, it leads to all the other issues that we are talking about. When a person
mm-hmm.
has a good education, they have the foundation to seek work at fair wages, thus decreasing their chances of becoming a criminal. So if we're dealing with the education and getting people where they are properly educated and they are able to go out and get affordable, fair wages, then we're gonna ultimately affect some of the other issues that create poverty in a community. So that definitely will be the hat that I will be wearing up to the state. It's great to have all those skills that I have, because now I'm able to relate when it's time to discuss tax incentives to get businesses to come into the community. And that's what we do on state level. We would make legislature.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the area of public education, do you believe that the state of Georgia for the last decade or so has been lacking in that area?
I think that the state of Georgia has done a phenomenal job as it relates to standards and creating the proper standards as for classrooms and how things should be conducted. We're doing very good. Some other states like Florida, they rank high as it relates to their standards, and we're right there, right behind them. So we got to give kudos to Georgia for establishing some wonderful standards and certifications for their teachers and making sure that good information is given out to their teachers via their website. I think the major issue as it relates to our schools is continuity. We're not getting the same performance at each school, even though they all have the same standards. And so what we may have to look at is what's working in one school, because there are plenty of schools that are in other districts and other parts of the state that have the same matrix. And when I mean matrix, the same diverse background of the students, the same type of teachers that are teaching in it, and they are performing better than some of the schools that are in District 139. So what we need to do is we need to say, hey, what are they doing that's working? What kind of programs do they have that they're using within these standards that we have here in the state of Georgia that's faring well their students? What initiatives do they have going on for their students for them to perform at this level for both their teachers, for both their teachers and their students? And so if we look at that a little bit more in depth, maybe we can, you know, take some of those good ideas that are working in those school systems and bring it to the district.
Okay, and I want to ask you one more question, and then I'll turn it back over to David. You know, we hear a lot about health care on a national level, but mm-hmm. can a legislature, in your opinion, also make a difference on this issue as well?
Oh, I think so. You know, that's what our ultimate job is, to make sure that we are creating good legislatures that are going to have an ultimate effect on the people, and as it relates to health care, I mean, that's important. I have I have plenty of people that live with me in my community that I live in that do not have any insurance, and that leads back to, you know, our job situation where they can have you know, a job where they can afford to go out and get an insurance plan. So, you know, as a legislature, you know, it would be my responsibility to make sure that good health initiatives are being passed on to the people in which I would be serving. So, yes, sir.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. David?
Yes. Well, as we said at the start of the interview, this is a special election, and we know that there's going to be a special session of the legislature in August. So if you mm-hmm. were to win the seat in a few weeks and not have to go to a runoff, which I'm not sure how many candidates there will be, you would go ahead and serve immediately for this redistricting session?
Yes. Yes, we would. We'll go right to work as a freshman in the House.
Yes, just immediately to work. But I guess that's good. The reward comes after the work of winning, you know, the campaign. So, well, if somebody's heard you, Ms. Jones, this evening on the Kudzu Vine and wants to get involved with your campaign, how can they do that?
Well, there are two ways that they can do that. We're on Facebook. It's under Anissa Jones, A-N-I-S-S-A, Jones Traditional. Or you can go to our website at VoteAnissaJones.com, and it has the information for you to place your information to get to us, and we'll contact you to get you on board to, you know, get on fire for what we're trying to do here and in Macon Bibb County.
Yes. Well, thanks again for joining us this evening.
And I'd like to make one more statement. I just want to remind everybody that, you know, early voting is going on right now. It's going to continue until July 15th. Our election day is on July 19th. You know, to make this happen, I really need your prayers, and I do need your vote. to help all of the things that we that I like to do for us and our community come to fruition. And I really do appreciate you guys giving me the opportunity to be on your show and to speak about things that I care passionately about, and that's this district and this state.
Thanks again.
Thank you, Doctor.
Mm-hmm. All right, bye-bye.
Yes. Well, that was the first of our two guests. That's our candidate guest for the evening, who's running for office down in Macon. And then we'll have Robert Hooks come on in a minute. But until then, let's turn our attention to Texas. And Rick Perry, we seem to continue to mention Rick Perry because he'll lean this way, and then he'll pull back, and then he'll make this move. Well, two things, I guess, happened this week, both reported on Political Wire. One, they took a poll of Texas political insiders, folks that I guess know the state best, and a majority of them think he'll run. So, you know, for whatever, you know, whatever rumblings they've heard, they've put it together thinking that he'll do it. And then probably more importantly, he is personally calling activists in Iowa. Now, obviously, the Texas governor, while he might care about Iowa in some way, I don't think he'd take the time just to call activists in Iowa unless he was interested in winning their caucus. What do you think, Tim?
Oh, gee. If he runs, he needs to get ready to go pretty fast. I just keep thinking back to the example of Fred Thompson. And he didn't announce until September of 07 that he was even going to run. He dangled his name out there forever, 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 forever. And looked like a solid, strong candidate, but when he finally did get in, he just never caught fire. If Governor Perry's going to run, he needs to get ready to go right now. He's got a staff to get together. He's got money to raise. He needs to get going. And the reason he needs to get going right now, he and Michelle Bachmann, in my opinion, are going to be going after the same voters in the state of Iowa. And so he's going to have to derail her. I think there's a place for him to go, David. Some Republicans, especially the more conservative ones, are desperately, I think, looking for the, shall I say, Annie Romney candidate. The social conservatives, the Tea Party folks just do not like Romney. They do like Michelle Bachmann, but I don't think they're quite convinced that she can actually go all the way and win. Now, you know, according to some already, the dream ticket is Perry Rubio. Well, if that's true, Perry needs to jump in there. That's the long and short of it, don't you think?
Well, I think if he was going to be the top of the ticket, he would actually have to get in the race. That seems to be a given. But Tim, before I turn over to Catherine, I do want to ask you one question. You make an interesting comparison between he and Fred Thompson. What
right.
is that date? What? And you can give month. You don't even. I won't even pin you down to day of the week or date. Just the month.
When is the month
that he has to get in by before he turns into Fred Thompson?
I think he needs to get in within 2 weeks. If he waits until September, I think he's waited too long. Yeah.
Goodness.
Yeah, I do.
Well, Catherine, your thoughts on this?
Well, I agree completely with what Tim said. I think he is risking a lot by waiting if he is planning on getting in, because Michelle Bachmann, surprising as it may seem, is gaining traction. I mean, it seems that way anyway. She's certainly getting a lot of attention. Or maybe she will after this week of craziness from Orlando is over. I'm so glad we're not talking about that tonight. But I do think it's going to be important for him to get in, and I agree that he needs to get in before August, because August is kind of a dead month. You know, people go on vacation. School starts. There's like a lot of other distractions. I mean, obviously, all of us inside baseball people will be paying attention, but I think it's going to be a tough row to hoe if he decides, you know, like the beginning of August. He's going to jump in then. I think he's going to be battling for media and just regular, you know, citizen attention because of all the things that will be going on. So I think he needs to get in the next 2 weeks, and I think he needs to – I mean, I agree with you that he's attracting the same voters as Michelle Bachmann. I don't know how he's going to take her out, though.
Yeah, she's really gaining some fire. The best time to me would have been getting in would have been to get in quickly after Mike Huckabee decided not to run, because he had a decent pool of support in Iowa, and that was, there was a vacuum there. And then, of course, then Newt Gingrich implodes. Now, that was a lot of Georgia names, I guess, that came up for grabs, if you will, but those plenty got pretty quick. Okay. And so he's missing these opportunities.
David, do you agree with me then that time is running out quickly?
I think it is, and this guy seems to want to run. I'm sure he has the fundraising mechanism to raise money quickly, and obviously that's a big issue with candidates if you don't get in to raise money. But in a place like Iowa where you have to line up people that influence people, that is becoming very critical. And so if he doesn't have good phone calls with these Iowa activists, then that's going to cause a problem. And speaking of Bachmann, well, I guess we can't get into it. Our next guest is Robert Hooks, and he's called in. If we have any time after Robert, we'll talk about Michelle Bachmann and a very crazy statement I heard this past week. But I want to talk
to
imagine
that. Instead.
Yeah, well, Robert, welcome back to the Kudzu Vine.
I am so glad to be back. The only thing that would make it better would be to be doing it from Georgia.
Oh, okay. Well, we got Georgia covered a little bit, so we got that part. But we got to have some Mississippi knowledge. Now, the one reason Mississippi is such an intriguing state this time is y'all actually have gubernatorial and statewide elections down the ballot. And your gubernatorial election has a competitive primary on both sides. I'm going to go ahead and start off by asking about that, and I'm going to let Tim and Catherine ask about some other races, and I may ask about some more. But give us kind of an update on the Democratic and Republican primaries and how those are falling out.
Well, you have an extraordinary situation in the Republican primary for governor. You have the incumbent lieutenant governor, Phil Bryant, who has spent the last 4 years being the mini-me to Haley Barbour and not doing it very well, really just getting pounded by several Republican candidates against him. And it's interesting because it's difficult to tell you if they're coming from the left or the right. They're just calling him out for being incompetent, for not managing the state very well. Our lieutenant governor presides over the Senate, so nothing happens the lieutenant governor doesn't approve. And everything that Governor Barbour has done that people don't like, they're putting on Phil Bryant. And it deserves to be put on Phil Bryant. He bears responsibility. But where Governor Barbour will get credit, Phil isn't. Where Governor Barbour doesn't get blame, Phil Bryant is taking the blame. On the Democratic side, you have two candidates, Bill Luckett, a lawyer, a very successful businessman who's been able to do some great work in the Delta, even in a bad economy, and one of my dearest friends and perhaps one of the most stellar, outstanding mayors in the entire country for any small town, Johnny Dupree, is running. Mayor Dupree has managed to maintain city services in one of the biggest cities in our state, a university city, Hattiesburg, has been able to maintain services without raising taxes once, without cutting one job or one service. He's done this in this god-awful economy. So you've got two strong Democrats that are running. I have no idea who's going to win, but it's going to be a heck of a general election.
Yeah, it sounds like if nothing else, Johnny Dupree could go on a tour of towns in America and say, hey, this is what we did, and it would help a lot of people across the country.
He probably could do more doing that than he could as governor.
Well, that's an interesting statement on the governor's race. Well, tell me this. Have there been any polls within the primaries? Now, of course, not head-to-head, put this candidate of Democrats against this candidate of Republicans, but are there any primary polls out there?
I have seen them for legislative races, you know, of course, but I have not been privy to any statewide polling on the statewide level. I have talked to people in both camps as well as other statewide camps, and, you know, being a professional political consultant, I can smell it a mile away. And they all say that they're up. And if there's certain buzzwords we all use when we're on a campaign. You can always tell when one of us are fibbing the truth a little bit, because we'll always say, man, we're almost there. If someone says we're almost there, that means they're 15 points down. And, you know, it's just the nature of the game. And all of them are saying that. So my guess is that if the statewide polling is reflecting what we're seeing in several individual districts, you probably still have as many as one in four primary voters undecided. And they're scrapping it out right now for those one in four. It could go either way, I would imagine.
Yeah. Yes, well, we'll kind of continue to watch that. I take it it's the same on the Republican side, no hard evidence.
I believe it was Newsweek or perhaps Time. One of the major magazines said that the Mississippi Republican race was one of the tightest in the country, and was expected to be. They had done some polling, and in the primary, and they were saying that this was about 2 weeks ago, and they were reporting that Republican primary was anybody's game. My guess is that Phil Bryant will probably solidify a significant number of right now undecided voters. I don't know that, but my guess is that Phil Bryant will probably, and with some comfort, be the Republican nominee.
Yes. Well, we'll continue to watch it, and Tim, I believe, has some questions about the current governor, among other things. Tim, I'm going to pass it to you.
Yes, sir. Mr. Hooks, the last time we spoke on here a few months back, Haley Barbour was gearing up for a presidential run. Well, since then, of course, we know that has, shall we say, crashed and burned. So what's the word on the street down there? Is the governor finished in politics after his present term ends, or is there any talk about that?
Now, if we're going to make fun of Mississippi presidential candidates, we're going to have to talk about Newt Gingrich, too, now. I can't let Georgia off the hook that easy. No, I don't believe Governor Barbour is finished in Mississippi politics. I think that he has, before he ran for governor, and certainly when his term ends, will make a fortune in the private sector as a lobbyist. His nephew, Henry Barbour, runs what is easily the most successful, exponentially so, the most successful lobbying firm in Mississippi, Capital Resources, very powerful, very professional operation, but very powerful, and that's just in our... that's just one in one small state where Governor Barbour will undoubtedly have out, you know, his hands in many states. But we have a Senate seat that may be coming open. I don't know if Thad Cochran, our United States Senator since I believe 1978, I would suspect he's not going to run for re-election. I do not know that. If Governor Barbour decided to run for the United States Senate, which you know he ran in 19. I believe it was 1982, and has the distinction of having lost 79 of 82 counties. A lot's changed since then, and he would be a very viable candidate before the United States Senate were he to run, which does not speak well for the quality of the Senate. I was mentioning the other day about United States Senators from Mississippi. Now, he ran against John Stennis, one of the last great giants of the Senate. And it boggles my mind that Mississippi went from electing John Stennis to Trent Lott and now Roger Wicker. So you go from one of the most honorable men to serve in the Senate to one of the most, one might say, you know, smart like a fox members of the Senate to perhaps one of the most intellectually slow members of the Senate. I think Mississippi can do better than Roger Wicker. I think we can do better than Haley Barbour. But what we have to do, and we share this with Georgia, and we have been doing a good job, and I think you'll see it in 2015, but it is that we have been building a back bench, and we have a lot of Democrats here who are in their 30s, some in their 40s, who are marinating, preparing to run for a lot of offices. I think the Democratic Party in this election cycle is probably at the lowest it's been for our state. But it is so fascinating to see these younger people who are running, who are winning districts where Republicans are typically winning in federal elections 70-plus percent. Our guys are winning legislative candidates, countywide candidates. And I think when that Senate seat comes up, if Governor Barbour runs for it, there will be a powerful, viable Democrat run.
Okay. Now, the next question I'm going to ask you about is something that we've actually never talked about when we've talked to you before, but it's something that's close to your heart. Here in Georgia, we recently elected all new state party leadership. One of the things they're trying to do is build up local groups of young Democrats. Now, you obviously have some experience with that. And my question is, how are the young Democrats doing in the state of Mississippi?
The young Democrats are doing pretty well. All of that kind of organizing is such a digital model now that it's a little difficult to quantify it the way it would have been 10 years ago or even 7 years ago. You could quantify it by something as simple as calling into a county and saying, we need X number of volunteers, how many can you get? Or you could have a state convention, and you could, which is and measure it by how many delegates showed up. You know, was it a convention of 300 people, or was it a convention of 75 people? Now, with the world being so digital and computer software allowing us to do telephone calls, which is one of the major things you use volunteers for, allowing us to do telephone calls with anybody with a computer connection anywhere in the country, for that matter, when we send emails out or we send text messages out and say, you know, we need X number of people to make phone calls into this district, it's a little difficult for me. Maybe I'm a little too removed at this point to quantify it. I do know that its state leadership is very strong, very smart, very much looking towards the future. But any group, particularly younger people, but now more and more just about anyone, is moving so digital that I can't give you an exact number other than to say that our colleges are obviously strong when I go there, and I think they're doing very well.
Okay, thank you, sir. Let me turn it over to Catherine now. Catherine?
Hello, how are you doing tonight? Thank you so much for
joining us. I'm doing well, thank you.
I wanted to ask you about how things are going with redistricting in Mississippi, because we're having a big battle here, and I imagine it's not much different over there.
Well, it has effectively ended right now because all of our legislators are in campaign mode. And while the failure of our legislature to pass a redistricting plan, it was a failure of the Senate, the House passed one, while the legislature could not agree on a redistricting plan, they are, as you can imagine, almost singularly focused on this November or this August, depending on if they have a general or a primary or both. And I think behind the scenes there may be some work with a few leaders in the House and Senate going on. But most of our members are, as I say, singularly focused on this November. But it will be a free-for-all, and I will tell you, this Democrats who sat at home, they don't vote in state races, they only vote in federal races, and sometimes they miss those. We have been telling them, redistricting can be the most important political reality that you have to vote for. And some listened and a lot didn't. And there are going to be people who are going to be living in districts that don't look like their neighborhoods, who don't represent them, perhaps lose a congressional seat or make a congressional seat for a Democrat more difficult, if not impossible, to win. This is a big deal. And I'll tell you, Democrats have got to get better because in Georgia and in Mississippi, we do not have the votes to win any major election based on core Democratic voters. We have got to get much better at identifying so-called swing voters, but people who probably more or less identify as conservatives, and convince them to vote with us on election by election, candidate by candidate. It's why our candidates have to be better than their candidates do. Because no matter what district we have, and this is what I've told everyone, losing is not an option. If we have a redistricting plan that favors Democrats, fantastic. But if we get a redistricting plan that favors Republicans, losing, surrender is just not an option. We fight and we win. And if we're not willing to fight, if we're not willing to win, we don't deserve to be in this process.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I know. So Howard, so that it failed out of the Senate, the Mississippi Senate, the redistricting plan. So
that's
then,
right.
What happens?
The courts. It went to the federal court. Moved very quickly in a matter of weeks. The courts have ordered that we run again this year in our current districts. It is possible that those elected this year will serve the next 4 years. It is possible that they will have to run again next year. If they cannot pass a legislative redistricting plan next year, the federal courts will impose one upon them. But it is anybody's guess as to what will happen. The reason it failed was because Phil Bryant was scared about his Republican primary. His polling data showed that the majority of Mississippi Republicans were not sold on him. And if he had passed a plan that, even though it favored Republicans in the Senate, which is Republican-controlled, the fact that it was fair in the House of Representatives and didn't cut the throats of Democrats in the House, he was scared of the Tea Party. He was scared of that belligerent group of strange
right.
people who now occupy that party. And he would not pass it. So we passed the plan. The joint committee made up of House and Senate members passed it. The House representatives passed it. The Senate just refused to take it up on a vote.
Huh. Interesting. Well, that's all I have. I'm going to send it back to David.
Yes. Well, of course, there's a governor's race, but there's also some down ballot races going on. Tell us some of the highlights of either primary contest, or you can even start looking ahead to the general election.
You know, I really believe that in Mississippi, where our party matters the most is in the legislature. This current district plan that we're running in has never elected a Republican majority in either house. Though the Senate is Republican controlled, it was due to some party switching. Now, this is interesting because this happened last cycle. It elected majority Democrats. There was some party switching, and then Democrats came back and defeated them. Party switching is a real difficult problem for our party, but these districts, as they're drawn, favor good candidates, not partisan candidates. And I think you should look to our legislative races. If the elections were held today, at this moment, I believe Democrats would easily maintain control of the House of Representatives, perhaps pick up a couple of seats. And the Senate, I think, could go either way, but certainly could potentially go Democratic. But the election is not going to be held today. Look for some real fights in East Mississippi, Northeast Mississippi, where you have some open seats. The Speaker, of course, is not running for reelection. His seat is open. Fantastic Democratic candidate, Tommy Cadle, is running up there. I think that he's well-liked, well-respected. But you also have two other open seats up there where Democrats have retired. And it's going to be a real fight. I think we'll win those seats, but it's not going to just be handed to us. We'll have to fight all the way through November.
Yes. Now one that wasn't on politics, one that's still a race we're interested in because he's been on our show more than once, Marshawn Crisler run for transportation commissioner. Is that a primary race or is that straight to general? What's that looking like?
That is a general election race, and Marshawn will win that. I almost never make political predictions, but Marshawn will flip that seat. That district voted. That district is made up of the central third of Mississippi. It runs from the Mississippi River across to Alabama. It's the middle third, and the transportation commission is a very important seat. It's the third biggest budget in the state. The three commissioners control the economic development funds, all of the funds that go through the Department of Transportation, and how well that department is managed affects literally tens of thousands of private sector jobs, not to mention the people who work for the Department of Transportation. Marshawn's district voted last, or 2008, it went, I think, 52% for Barack Obama. It voted for John Arthur Eaves over Haley Barbour for governor and straight down the ticket. Marshawn is such a credible candidate, so smart, so strong. I just cannot imagine him not winning that, which would be a flip because it's currently held by a Republican, and I think that's going to flip to Democratic.
Yes, and then the state treasurer's race, I believe, Connie Moran, she's going to be on our show in coming weeks. She said she'll come on with us. We don't know the exact date yet. Give us a little preview of what that race is about just so our listeners will know a little bit when she comes on.
Well, Connie Moran is the current mayor of Ocean Springs, a city obliterated by Hurricane Katrina. She was reelected in that city out of literally appreciation because she has fought so hard and done so well of taking this beautiful, small, historic city that was destroyed and rebuilding it. And you cannot, you barely can, unlike any other coastal city, the effects of Katrina cannot really be seen in Ocean Springs, even though it's literally right on the beach in Mississippi. She has, her background is banking and finance. She's worked in banks. She understands bonds. As the mayor, she's had to handle millions of dollars of bonds for her city, which is the primary responsibility of the treasurer from whether or not they can create jobs for the state or not, which will be the issue they're going to all run on. She is so good at it. She is a credible candidate. Mississippi needs a great treasurer. Frankly, all of our states need more women in office. We have a horrible underrepresentation of women in elected office. And what's beautiful is the Republican primary is cut three or four ways. I couldn't hope to tell you who's going to win the Republican primary. And none of the candidates are terribly impressive. So I think that is it's going to be a fight, but I think Mayor Connie Moran has a great chance at that seat.
Yeah. Well, one final thing I wanted to ask you about, Robert, it's not about an actual race. It's regarding your use of Facebook, and I know periodically for the past maybe year, half year, you'll go on and do a web video that you'll put on there, and I've noticed that you'll get these tons of comments. How did you come about doing it, and what's been your secret for having so many people interested in your videos?
Well, one is that I post them very seldom, and two, I have not really shied away from topics of some controversy. Until just a few weeks ago, I have served as political director to the Speaker of the House here in Mississippi, Billy McCoy. He is not running for re-election. So I have moved on to other things. In fact, I'm going to be in Atlanta next week. I'm going to be in Little Rock the following week, Oklahoma City right after that. I'm sort of touring around, helping out where people have said that they need me. But what it has meant is that I have been a little bit more free to say what I really think about elections than what perhaps I would have been when my comments could have been directly reflected on the speaker. And I just posted a video, I guess it was last week, about House District 19 as one to watch, where an incumbent could very well lose the primary. And if he doesn't lose the primary, he could very well lose the general election, or you have some strong primary opponents against him. I hope people find them interesting, and I hope they don't find me too terribly unattractive. And maybe that's why they go to it. Maybe they think I talk funny. I hear that a lot.
I don't know, and I tell you what, Robert, if you make tour T-shirts for this tour you're talking about, of course, send us some. But,
absolutely.
Robert, we want to thank you for coming on the Kudzu Vine this evening.
Well, thank you so much for having me. You all have a great night.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
Yes. Well, that was certainly fascinating for Mississippi politics. And what we're probably planning to do is they've got their elections about 22 days away, I guess 3 weeks this after this Tuesday. We'll go ahead and see how this unfolds. And I'm sure Robert will come back on between the primary and the general, maybe even more than once, given that Mississippi, Louisiana, two of the big states this odd year. But we've taken this thing right up about to 8 o'clock. I don't think we could begin to cover another topic, you know, like we should. So I think we ought to call this an evening. What do y'all think?
I agree with you.
Sounds good. Good night,
evening,
guys.